Chapter 9 Problem Solving, Creativity and Related Ideas. Introduction and Definitions. There are many types of problems in organizations, as well as in daily life. Solving these problems can result in a more functional organization and an enhanced quality of life. Some problems require a considerable amount of creativity to solve, and some are routine difficulties with obvious solutions. The above suggests the questions: what precisely do the words problem and creativity mean? This will be discussed in the following paragraphs. A definition of the word problem from Franklin Language Master Electronic Dictionary LM 5000 is something requiring thought and skill to arrive at a proper conclusion or decision. This was a quoted definition from Robbins. Organizational behavior is a discrepancy between some current state of affairs and some desired state. This was a quote. The first definition is not precise. Robbins' definition is a fairly good delineation of the concept. However, this chapter is dealing with problem solving, which implies obtaining a goal, which is the solution. Thus, I will provide my own definition, based on a goal, in the following paragraph. A problem is a state of reality that an individual would like to change in such a way as to obtain a goal. The word goal means the solution to the problem. The word state of reality means in this definition any real or hypothetical set of circumstances, entities, geometric relationships, factors, mathematical representations, situations, structures, symbols, etc. The word individual in the definition is used in a general sense and it means any entity that can engage in the problem-solving process, such as yourself, a person, an organization, a computer, or even an intelligent animal. The words "would like to change" implies that a problem exists as a result of a desire for a change in a reality state. If there is no recognition of a specific reality state and/or no desire for an improved reality state by an individual, there is no problem, from the frame of reference of that individual. There might be dysfunctional circumstances, but such a condition might not be recognized or defined as a problem by the individuals involved with the situation. The word problem can also be defined as a set of circumstances that one would like to change to a more desirable reality state. The more desirable reality state is the goal or solution to the problem in this definition. Creativity and problem-solving formulas. Problem-solving often involves creativity, which suggests the question: what is creativity? Helriegel and Slocum defined creativity as the ability to visualize, foresee, generate, and manipulate new ideas. This was a quote. The Webster's Dictionary defines it as one, the quality of being creative to the ability to create. This was a quote. I am defining creativity for this book as the ability to create new entities, such as new methodologies, ideas, theories, structures, solutions to problems, works of art, etc. The word new in this definition means new to the creator. For example, if an individual created an entity that was already invented with her own creative thoughts and efforts, the process would still be creativity. A concept closely related to the above is the creative process, which is defined by Luthans and Hojets PG3 as generating new or unique ideas, involving four steps: preparation, incubation, illumination, and verification. This was a quote. There are other definitions and models of the creative process besides the above. I will present some of this information later on in this chapter, including a general model of the creative process. However, I believe it will be interesting to examine the four steps presented by Luthans and Hojets, as follows. 1. Preparation is the process of preparing yourself for creative activities. This involves studying material that relates to your creative or problem-solving efforts. This can involve formal learning, casual reading, discussions with others to gain information, asking questions, informal or formal experimentation to obtain data, etc. 2. Incubation. This step involves an incubation of the information that was obtained in step 1 and from earlier periods of study and experience. The theoretical idea is that the subconscious mind needs time to process the information into new forms that can be used in your creative efforts. During this period, the mind arranges and rearranges the information into a form that might result in new insights or a new solution to the problem you are working on. 3. Illumination. This is the point where insight develops. The person might suddenly become aware of a new idea, solution, theory, structure, etc. 4. Verification. This involves testing of the new idea, solution, theory, methodology, structure, entity, etc., that became apparent in step 3. This four-step creative process suggests a question, and some limitations of the method. That is, what if the incubation period does not result in illumination, or if it results in insights that are not adequate to solve the problem you are working on? The answer is there are more sophisticated and effective methods of creativity and problem solving than the above. However, The above four-step creative process sometimes works, and these steps are often incorporated into more sophisticated methods. Incidentally, I found from experience that, during the incubation period, if I deliberately arrange and rearrange the relevant information with the writing process on a computer screen, I obtain many insights and potential solutions to problems illumination. A method based on this idea, which is meant for very difficult problems and goals, is outlined below, in five steps. 1. Define the goal. The goal can be to solve a problem, insight into a specific area of study, the creation of an entity, or any objective. In the process of defining the goal, you should consider the feasibility of dividing it into smaller goals, which can be achieved easily. This idea is especially useful for very difficult problems. Sometimes a problem that cannot be resolved with conventional techniques can be solved if it is divided into smaller problems, which can be worked out individually. This step, defining the goal, can be greatly facilitated by writing the information that you have on a computer screen, with appropriate software. This can include dividing the goal into sub-goals and estimating the cost and time involved for each of the sub-goals. This can also be done at a later point in time. 2. Study the relevant material that relates to the goal you defined in step 1. This can involve any type of study, such as reading, experimentation, formal classroom study, tutoring, learning from the experience of others, etc. This study should include material that directly relates to your goal coupled with information that is only indirectly related to the goal. This study should include a check with experts and/or the literature to see if there is an established formulation to obtain your goal. It is often useful to study the same goal from the perspectives of different disciplines, such as studying a human behavior problem, from a psychological, social-psychological, a sociological, anthropological, and a psychiatric perspective. In general, the more detailed and prolonged the study, the greater the chances of obtaining your goal, especially if it involves solving a difficult problem. Keep in mind that this is the most important step on the list. After extensive study, you might want to go back to step 1 and redefine your goal. This is especially useful if the information you obtained indicated that the goal cannot be obtained with the time, money, and expertise you have available. 3. Write what you know and have learned in relation to obtaining your goal, which should be done with a computer with word processing software. The writing process can start as soon as you start your problem-solving efforts. However, it is especially important to write what you learned, and your thoughts and ideas after step 2. This process can include writing questions that relate to your goal, and answering them in detail. Writing questions that have many answers can be especially useful, such as the following: what are all the possible causes for this problem? What are all the possible solutions to this problem? What are the names and telephone numbers of all the experts that I might be able to contact, who can help me obtain my goal? What are the names and numbers of all the people I know who can help me with this problem? What are all the methodologies that might help me obtain the goal? Can mathematics help me obtain relevant information? Will statistical analyses provide information I need to reach my objective? When you start this step, step 3, you can write with little concern for grammar, punctuation, or organization. However, as you continue the process, you should put the most relevant information into an organized form. When the writing process is coupled with arranging and rearranging information into a highly organized form, insights are likely to develop. This sometimes happens as a result of noticing one or more inconsistencies or failures in the theoretical framework you are developing. Such inconsistencies or failures suggest questions. When you write out such questions and answer them, new insights may result. 4. Select the relevant information you obtained in the first 3 steps, and put aside the information that is not useful. Take this information and try to create a step-by-step plan to obtain your goal. This can be done in writing. It can be useful to estimate the time and cost needed to achieve each step of your plan. 5. Check the final solution or evaluate the goal that you obtained. If the outcome is satisfactory, you solved your problem or obtained your goal. If it is not satisfactory, repeat the above steps. Try to find out what went wrong with the plans and try to make the needed corrections. The above is an example of a problem-solving formula that incorporates the creative process. There are many types of problem-solving formulas, some of which involve the creative process and others that do not involve creativity. Some of these formulas are specialized for specific problems and others have general application. In general, there are probably far more problem-solving formulas than there are human beings. Most people have many formulas in their mind that they consciously or unconsciously use to solve problems of various types. That is, most people, including managers and organizations, go through a series of specific steps when they are trying to solve a problem or obtain a goal. The relative capabilities of individuals, groups, or organizations to solve problems or obtain goals is very much determined by the appropriateness and effectiveness of the problem-solving formulas that they are using. The word "you're" in the following sentences means all of the following: yourself, your group, your department, your organization, etc. Becoming aware of your formulas and their limitations can lead to an increase in your problem-solving capability. You might find that some of the formulas you have been using unconsciously are ineffective or counterproductive, or cause significantly more problems than you started with. You will probably also find that some of your problem-solving strategies work fine, and some of your formulas might work fairly well, but require some improvement. Thus, it will be helpful if we continue with our discussion of problem-solving formulas and creativity. The simplest problem-solving formula can involve only three easy steps, without any creative process. Formulas similar to the following are probably carried out on a more or less unconscious level when most people face relatively simple problems. 1. Problem recognition. This involves becoming aware that there is a problem. 2. Planning a series of steps to solve the problem, and carrying them out. This is often done in the mind with simple problems. 3. Testing to see if the problem was solved. This can be done with observation with simple problems. A more complicated formula than the above can include one or two additional steps, such as searching for expert assistance and/or obtaining information to solve the problem. Perhaps the most useful formula for conventional problems can be represented in 5 steps, as follows. 1. Define the problem or goal. 2. Study the problem or goal and related information that you need for your objective. 3. Consider expert assistance to help you solve your problem or goal. There are, of course, situations where much expert assistance is essential. There are other situations where expert help is totally unnecessary. The idea is to determine whether there is or is not a need for expert assistance in a particular situation. 4. Create a plan that will solve your problem or help you obtain your goal. 5. Evaluate the outcome to see if you solved your problem or obtained your goal. If you failed, evaluate all the above steps and other information and make appropriate corrections. This can involve repeating all of the steps one or more times. Difficult problems may require many repetitions of the above steps, or a more sophisticated problem-solving formula. A more complicated problem-solving formula is presented in the Handbook of Problem-Solving by Stephen J. Andreil, which he calls the problem-solving process. This formula is outlined in the first chapter of Andreil's book. It is apparently meant for very difficult problems that could not be solved in the mind of one individual. Andreil describes it in the glossary of his book pages 179 as follows: problem-solving process. The process of tool assessment, organization, documentation, and defense, and the selection and implementation of descriptive, explanatory, predictive, prescriptive, and evaluative analytical methodologies all in an effort to solve a specific analytical problem. This was a quote. Chapters 2 through 10 of Andreil's book explains each element of the formula, problem-solving process, which is summarized as follows. 1. Problem-solving tools. Problem-solving talent, data and information, methods, approaches, time, and support. This refers to the resources needed for problem-solving, such as personnel with the needed abilities, your own problem-solving skills, relevant information, knowledge of the methodology needed to solve the problem, and the time to do the required work to solve the problem. A deficiency in these tools can greatly reduce the chances of successfully solving the problem. Thus, this step includes a search, which can be internal or external, for individuals with the needed skills to carry out the tasks needed to solve the problem, unless you have all the required skills and time to do the work yourself. 2. Problem-solving organization. The aggregate process comprised of requirements analyses, problem identification, problem structuring, constraint analyses, and project management. This was a quote. This includes defining the problem or problem identification, analyzing the structure of the problem, collecting relevant information, and managing the problem-solving effort. 3. Description. The process by which events and conditions are profiled in order to determine similarities, differences, ranges, variations, and interrelationships. This was a quote. This involves a description of the problem, which can be in the form of one or more memorandum, letters, reports, etc. The description can describe the problem and related data. This can include mathematical data that relates to the problem and its solution. 4. Explanation. The process by which events and conditions, often expressed as variables, are linked to one another in measurable relationships whereby the changes in one set of variables can be related to changes in another set of variables. This was a quote. This includes explaining how and why something happens or happened. The explanations can include mathematics and detailed written descriptions. 5. Prediction and forecasting, the process by which future events and or conditions are identified and assessed. This was a quote. This involves an assessment of the information available with the goal of determining what will happen in the future. The probabilities of various positive or negative outcomes might be estimated in mathematical terms. To obtain this insight, the problem solver might look at current trends, use subjective judgment, use the Delphi method, etc. 6. Prescription. The selection from competing alternatives of a single option. Recommendations made on the basis of analytical steps taken to resolve uncertainty in a decision situation. This was a quote. This step involves the decision-making process, which can be important in the problem-solving process. It includes choosing between alternative possibilities, entities or courses of action, in relation to the problem-solving effort. This step deals with choosing how something is going to be done, such as the following 7 questions presented in Anriel's book in Chapter 7, Prescription 1. How is the information that comes to the attention of decision makers gathered and processed? 2. How are recommendations made and promoted? 3. How are general rules prescribed? 4. How are the general rules provisionally invoked in reference to conduct? 5. How are general rules applied? 6. How is the working of prescriptions appraised? 7. How are the prescriptions and arrangements entered into within the framework of such rules brought to termination? This was a quote. 7. Evaluation. The process by which entities and processes are evaluated against sets of explicit evaluative criteria. This was a quote. This involves the assessment of various entities that are involved with the problem. For example, if the problem involved inadequate production, the relevant machinery and employees might be evaluated to determine what is the primary cause of the problem. 8. Documentation reports, memoranda, presentations, videotape, video discs, tape recordings, slides, viagraphs, and all other written or audiovisual means by which analytical results are described. This was a quote. This step involves explaining the problem, the actions needed to solve it, and the solution, in some recorded form, such as a written record, a tape recording, a video, etc. This step is important to obtain funding and other resources, including the assistance of experts. 9. Defense. The process by which analytical solutions are explained, communicated, and defended, usually via briefings, argumentation, and negotiation. This was a quote. The ideas, theories, and plans that relate to a problem-solving effort often have to be defended. This step is important when the explanations for the problem, the plans, and proposed solution are to be evaluated by others. This can be done to interest experts in the problem-solving effort or to obtain funding. Thus, without a successful defense, the assistance and resources required to solve the problem may not be obtainable. The defense is especially necessary because people do not always read or understand all of the documentation. Such individuals can inadvertently create erroneous arguments against the proposed problem-solving plan. A good defense will explain the relevant information and demolish invalid arguments, without insulting others. If there are any valid arguments against the plans or other documentation involved with the problem-solving effort, the course of action to take is to correct the deficiencies and continue the defense based on the corrected material. Anriel's problem-solving formula is fairly extensive, but its structure is not convenient and it is not in a highly logical form. For example, problem identification should be the first item on the list. There are also certain steps that are often irrelevant for many types of problems, such as 9 defense. Of course, when steps are irrelevant in a specific problem-solving situation, they can be ignored. However, Anriel's problem-solving formula, and his book, does not emphasize the most important components of problem-solving, which are the studying and learning process, the creation of a detailed step-by-step plan to solve the problem, obtaining financial resources for the problem-solving effort, and a feedback and correction procedure. The formula and book do not emphasize creative thinking either, which is important for very difficult problems that do not have apparent solutions. However, the book is written on a fairly sophisticated level, and the author probably assumed that the reader would be quite aware of the above, which are obvious necessities for difficult problems. However, I will present a 12-step formula that emphasizes the essential components of problem solving a little later in this chapter. As previously stated, one of the factors that determines problem solving capabilities is the formulas that are used to solve problems and obtain goals. Another factor is people, groups, and organizations have variations in their problem-solving power. Specifically, there are variations in the expertise and financial resources available to solve problems and obtain goals. Highly educated people working at wealthy organizations with great technical resources and many experts generally have much problem-solving power. Thus, it is probably apparent from the above that two of the primary limitations of problem-solving and goal attainment are financial limitations and lack of technical knowledge. In the case of an individual, her problem-solving capability will probably be limited by her social class. If the individual comes from a poor and uneducated social class, she will have little problem-solving power. Such an individual will not have the financial resources or knowledge needed to solve certain types of problems or obtain difficult goals. An individual in this category could probably not obtain useful assistance for difficult problem-solving or goal attainment from her family or friends, because they most likely would have the same financial and educational limitations as she does. The situation, of course, would most likely be just the opposite with an individual that was from a wealthy and highly educated social class. However, even wealthy and educated people, groups, and organizations can be limited at times in problem-solving and goal attainment because of lack of expertise or financial resources. The above suggests the question: is there a problem-solving formula that can circumvent limitations that result from deficiencies in expertise and financial resources? The answer is yes. Even Andriel's formula, which was presented above, indirectly suggests some ways of circumventing these difficulties. This involves obtaining personnel with appropriate skills and documentation, which can be used to obtain resources. The following 12-step formula is focused on obtaining expert assistance and resources, as well as suggesting a method of solving a problem or obtaining a goal. The 12 steps are presented after the delineation of the instructions for the formula, as follows. General instructions: the 12 steps in this formula are primarily meant for difficult problems and challenging goals. For less challenging objectives, some of the steps will appear irrelevant and can be skipped. The steps are numbered from 1 to 12, which is the most convenient order to follow when using the formula. However, there are likely to be many situations where the formula will work better if the steps are performed in an order that differs from 1 to 12, such as 3, 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. In addition, with certain problems and goals, it might be necessary to repeat a step or return to it one or more times after other steps were completed. If there is a difficulty completing a step, return to it after completing other steps on the list. There are questions in this formula, which you are to answer. Type the questions and your answers into a computer with word processing software. Each answer should ideally be at least one paragraph long, with the question serving as an introductory topic sentence. Questions that are irrelevant to the problem-solving effort should be either ignored or modified so they are relevant. In addition, all the writing that is done, in relation to this formula, should be typed into the computer with word processing software. The formula contains the words you and your, but this does not imply that its application is limited to the individual. In addition, several people, a group, or even one or more departments of an organization can be using the same formula, simultaneously while working on the same problem. This is possible because the following formula utilizes computer technology, which allows a number of individuals to add information to the system simultaneously. 1. What is your objective? Is it to find a solution to a problem, create a new entity, or some other goal? Write about your objective in detail, and explain why it is important. 2. Can you divide your goal into smaller and simpler problems or goals that can be more easily obtained? If this might be possible, try to do it. That is, try to break your goal or problem into smaller units, and define these units in written language. 3. Study the information you need to obtain your objective. Determine the information you need to learn by answering the following questions. What information relates directly to the problem or goal you are working on? Is there any information that relates indirectly to your problem or goal that might be helpful in your efforts? Will it be helpful to study your problem or goal from many different disciplines, such as management theory, organizational behavior, sociology, anthropology, psychology, social psychology, political science, economics, etc.? That is, can a multidisciplinary approach help you solve your problem? Can you obtain the information you need from books, documents in your organization, discussions or tutoring with experts, formal study in a school environment, informal study methods, practice, formal experimental techniques, informal experimentation, the computer, the internet, the library, discussions with employees, observations, questionnaires given to experts, questionnaires given to a sample of consumers or other relevant individuals, etc.? In addition, make a written list of questions you want answered in relation to your study efforts. Place your questions in the computer in order of importance. When you obtain answers, write them up in detail under the appropriate questions. Study all the information you obtain and place your notes in the computer. Keep in mind the primary objective with this step is to learn how to solve the problem you are working on. Prolonged study is usually the most important factor to solve very difficult problems or to obtain an extremely challenging goal. For easier objectives, it might only be necessary to spend several minutes to study a few simple facts. 4. Use questions to help obtain your objective. Type into the computer a series of questions that relate to your problem, your goal, and your studying efforts. If you are dealing with a difficult goal or problem, try to create as many questions as you can, and then answer them in detail. Your list should include the following questions, which can be modified to make them more relevant to your objective. Based on your knowledge, experience, and the material you studied in Step 3, what are all the possible methods that can help you solve your problem or obtain your goal? What are all the possible causes for the problem you are working on? List the answers to this question in order of significance. Can the problem be represented in terms of a cause and effect diagram? Is there any testing method to determine what the real cause for the problem is? What are the names and telephone numbers of all the experts and knowledgeable individuals that might be able to help you solve your problem or obtain your goal? What are all the methodologies that might help you obtain your objective? Will mathematics or formal logic help you solve your problem or obtain your goal? Can inductive or deductive reasoning help you solve your problem or obtain your goal? Can statistics help you solve your problem? Can computer technology help you obtain your objective? Can a simulation model help you understand or solve your problem? Can a simulation model help you test possible solutions? Are there any possible risks involved with your problem-solving efforts? If there are risks, how can they be eliminated or reduced? How might your problem-solving effort affect the system? Are there any risks of unanticipated or unwanted consequences associated with your problem-solving efforts? Did you study enough to solve your problem? Should you return to Step 3 and continue studying? Are there any gaps in your knowledge as far as your problem-solving efforts are concerned? 5. Type your ideas and thoughts into the computer. Feel free to write as much as possible if you are attempting to obtain a difficult objective. At this point, it is not necessary to focus on grammar, organization, punctuation, or spelling. However, try to avoid unnecessary disorganization or errors, because that will make your work more difficult later. 6. This step involves a selection process. Before beginning this process, make a copy of all the data you compiled on another file. This process starts by examining all the data, including the questions and answers, you typed into your computer. Select the information and ideas that appear to be most useful for your objective. You will probably have much useless information, including many ideas that are not feasible. Before rejecting ideas that are not feasible, ask yourself why they are not feasible. Then ask yourself how can they be made feasible? If possible, ideas should be tested out before they are rejected. It is important to exclude useless data, but it is necessary to be extremely cautious not to exclude information that might lead to a unique solution or a path to your goal. If you are not sure if information is useful or useless, save it until you are sure that you cannot use it. If you still have information and ideas that are not useful, repeat the above a number of times until you have removed most, if not all, of the useless data. 7. Put the information and ideas you selected in Step 6 into an organized form and remove any grammar and spelling errors. This can be done with the word processing software functions, such as the copy function, the cut and paste function, the delete function, etc. Rewrite any ideas that are not clearly delineated. As you rewrite, look for inconsistencies in your logic, hypothetical or theoretical framework, because correcting such inconsistencies can lead to valuable insights. In general, the process of rewriting, organizing and removing errors can lead to a great deal of insight, which can help you reach your objective. The above can be repeated one or more times if necessary, to obtain a highly organized document. 8. Try and create a plan to solve your problem or obtain your goal, which should be primarily based on the information you organized in Step 6. However, you can still use information from other sources if it is helpful. Refine the plan you created. Write it out in terms of a series of steps, if possible. Try and estimate the time and money involved in completing each step. Try to determine the materials and assistance needed to complete each step. Try and estimate the possible risks involved with each step of your plan. Try to determine the total cost of completing your plan and obtaining your objective in terms of time, money, effort, risk, materials, etc. Make any needed modifications in your plan as a result of the above estimates. If you have created a good plan that is likely to lead to your objective, go on to step 9. However, if you were not able to create a satisfactory plan, consult experts or other knowledgeable individuals for assistance and repeat the steps of this formula. Step 3 is the primary item to repeat and focus on, because it involves the studying and learning you need to obtain your objective. That is, an inability to create the plans needed to solve a problem or obtain a goal suggests lack of relevant knowledge, which might be remedied by further study. 9. If you need to obtain resources to reach your objective, such as workers, machinery, tools, workspace, money, consider writing a report. A report can sometimes be used to obtain funding from your company, another organization, or from a government agency. Take your refined plan and any other information you wrote for the above steps, and rearrange it into a report, with the word processor functions. You can add any additional information or ideas if it is needed to create a good report. The report should have a summary on the first page. It should be written so it can be easily understood by the people who will read it. Your report should be created in a way that shows the benefits of your project from the perspective of the people who may provide the needed resources. 10. Try and obtain support for your plan from experts and people with power. This should include signed correspondence supporting your plan, your objective, your character and abilities. If you have to modify your report, your plan, or even your objective, to obtain such support, it will probably be worthwhile. In addition, be prepared to explain and defend your plans and other documentation, which may be necessary to win the acceptance of experts and other people with power. 11. Try and win unofficial acceptance of your project from the people that will supply the resources, before you officially submit your plan. This can be done with informal discussions and short letters from yourself and your prestigious supporters. It may be best to do this over a period of days, weeks or even months, which will allow the officials the time needed to become familiar with you, your plan, and your objective. If an official intentionally or inadvertently expresses some doubt about your efforts and plans, it can suggest one of the following: they need more information. You have to modify your plans or objectives to meet their requirements. You have to improve your proposed solution, goal or plans. You are discussing your project at the wrong point in time. You are requesting help with your project from the wrong source. In general, the time to submit your report officially is when the feedback suggests that the officials understand your plan, solution or goal, trust you, and appear to be willing to accept your project. The procedures suggested in this step are generally quite important, because top officials often do not have the time needed to read and evaluate every project that is submitted to them. They may make a decision based on whether or not they know and trust the person that submitted the plan. 12. The final step is feedback and correction. This involves checking and testing every aspect of the plan you created to reach your objective. It also involves evaluating your efforts in relation to every step in this formula. The final and most important evaluation is to determine if your plan led to the solution or a goal you were trying to obtain. If any of the above failed, modifications and corrections are needed in your plan, your methods, or any other component that was involved with your efforts. Before such changes are made, it might be necessary to determine what went wrong, and to do additional studying. In addition, requesting assistance from experts or people who have the needed experience can be helpful. It will probably be necessary to repeat most or all of the 12 steps in this formula, especially step 3, which involves studying and learning how to obtain your objective. If you are dealing with a fairly difficult problem or trying to obtain a very challenging goal, it might be necessary to repeat the 12 steps and related work a number of times before you achieve success. The above formula incorporates all of the components needed for difficult problem solving, including the creative process. At this point, I believe it will be useful to return to a discussion of creativity. We already discussed the creative process, as delineated by Luthans and Hojeffs. I will now present a more fundamental model of the process, which is a series of steps that are usually involved with the creation of a new entity, new methodology or new solution to a problem. The creative process, as described in the following model, is not a problem-solving formula, but it can be part of such a formula. The process, as presented in the model that follows, can be carried out consciously or unconsciously by an individual, group, organization, a computer, as well as by a society or nature in an evolutionary sequence. This will become apparent from the 5 fundamental steps involved in this model, which are as follows. 1. A general search, which is not very selective, is carried out for factors that might be useful in obtaining a goal. The factors can be ideas, structures, geometric relationships, entities, methods, or just about anything else that might be useful in obtaining the goal. At this point, the goal may or may not be precisely defined. The goal can be to solve a problem or obtain some other objective, such as the creation of a new entity. Two, the factors that were obtained in step 1 are evaluated for usefulness in relation to the goal. The useful factors are selected and the remainders are discarded. 3. One or more factors that were selected are applied to achieve the goal. This can involve placing the factors in specific arrangements, or combining them to a pre-existing entity. In addition, it can sometimes involve using a selected factor in a new way, such as using a carefully selected stone as a hatchet. This step can also involve the further evaluation of the usefulness of the factor S. There can be a trial and error process to see if the factor S fit S physically, logically, or functionally into an arrangement that relates to the goal. 4. Tests are carried out to see if the goal has been achieved. In some cases, a number of possibilities may have been created, and the testing is used to select the most feasible or effective solution or a prototype. The selected solution or a prototype might be further improved and/or tested before it is finally used. 5. If the solution or a prototype is reasonably effective, it might be applied in a practical way, which might include duplication of it on a relatively large scale. Examples are the mass production of a new product, the mass acceptance of a new cultural component such as style of dress, and in a biological evolutionary system, the natural selection of a new animal species, which results in proliferation of the species. The above model fits the various categories of brainstorming. It is also interesting to note that the model also fits the evolutionary processes that take place in nature and in societies. At this point, it might be useful to discuss this process in a general sense. The evolutionary process is a trial and error process that takes place spontaneously, over a period of time. It involves reducing or eliminating to certain entities which are unfit, weak, undesirable, or useless, and facilitates the development of other entities which are fit, strong, desirable, or useful. This idea will be discussed in the following paragraphs, which will lead to a discussion of the evolutionary process in relation to organizations and problem solving. We first learned about the concept of evolution in relation to biology, from Darwin. This process involves the production of many genetic variations, which more or less happens by random chance. The living entities that survive and pass on their genes are selected by environmental conditions, which include competing plants and animals. That is, the animals and plants that are not fit to survive in the specific environment die early and eventually fail to pass on their genes. These living entities are in effect selected out and removed by environmental conditions. The plants and animals that are fit to survive in the given environment reproduce and pass on their genes. Social evolution is more or less similar to biological evolution. It involves the selection by society of entities, ideas, or any component that fits in well with either its main culture or one or more of its subcultures. Any component that does not fit in well, even if it becomes popular for a while, will eventually be rejected, removed from the society, or greatly reduced in number. My primary reason for discussing this topic relates to the evolutionary processes that take place in organizations. Ideas, thoughts, beliefs, methods, cultures and subcultures that exist in organizations can develop as a result of the evolutionary process. In addition, solutions to problems and improvements in methods can also develop as a result of an evolutionary process. This suggests an interesting idea. Is it possible to deliberately start an evolutionary process that will lead to a solution to a problem, an improvement in a methodology or product? The answer is yes. For example, it is possible to produce many variations of a product and see which variation sells best over an extended period of time. It is also possible to make gradual product improvements over an extended period of time and see which modification improves sales. The product variations that are not selling well can be discontinued, and money and effort can be put into the product variations that are selling well. This can involve further gradual improvements in the product. In general, a number of variations, which involve potential improvements, can be created gradually over an extended period of time, in relation to an entity or method. These variations can be evaluated over a period of many weeks, months or years in regard to utility. The variations that are less successful are likely to be gradually rejected as a result of inferior utility. The variations that are more successful are likely to become highly accepted or popular as a result of superior utility. The superior entities can replace the inferior entities and they can be gradually improved further, with a repetition of this evolutionary sequence. Many of us, including people involved in the management process, carry out an evolutionary process in our occupational roles and in our daily lives. However, we are generally not aware of this process. If we become more aware of the evolutionary process in our business and personal lives, we might be able to control the results to our benefit. Some examples might be insightful. We might choose our friends without careful thought. We might become acquainted with the people in our environment, and we may select the individuals that we find satisfying or ethically acceptable over a period of time. We might inadvertently or intentionally reject or maintain a distance between other individuals that do not meet our selection criteria. We select many of our behavior patterns, including bad habits, by an evolutionary process. We might smoke one cigarette as an experiment, because our friends smoke, and if we find it enjoyable, we might eventually start to smoke on a regular basis, and become addicted to nicotine. If we find smoking undesirable, we might develop a non-smoking behavior pattern. Another example is the manager that hires her own employees might have selection criteria that relate to personality traits and work performance. Employees that do not meet the criteria might not be hired, or if they are, they might be encouraged to quit or they might be fired. Employees that meet the criteria might be encouraged to stay on the job. Such employees might be given compliments, raises, and promotions. The previous example can be extended to certain organizations that have a specific set of requirements for employees, and a clearly defined culture. See the chapter on organizational culture. When this is the case, the requirements of the organization and its culture are likely to act as an evolutionary selection process for employees. Over a period of time, certain personality types that fit the organizational philosophy and culture will remain with the organization, and other personality types will be rejected. Thus, it can be helpful to understand the evolutionary processes that take place in our environment. We do not want to be rejected. We also do not want to select inadvertently, such as the inadvertent selection of undesirable friends, habits, ways of thinking, etc. In addition, if we truly understand the evolutionary process, we can sometimes use it for problem solving and goal attainment. Another creative process is brainstorming. This is a fairly popular technique that involves the basic creative model that was previously discussed. Brainstorming is defined in the glossary of Robbins Organizational Behavior as an idea generation process that specifically encourages any and all alternatives, while withholding any criticism of those alternatives. This was a quote how Regal and Slocum defines the term pages 759 as an unrestrained flow of ideas in a group with all critical judgments suspended. This was a quote brainstorming involves a group of people, usually numbering from 5 to 12, who are instructed to verbalize their ideas, without critical evaluation, in relation to a specific problem or goal. The ideas are recorded by the group facilitator or other individual. The recording is best done on a blackboard or a similar device, so all the group members can read the ideas that have already been suggested. This is an important component of brainstorming, because the ideas that were already presented, and placed on the blackboard for all to see, may stimulate the creative thinking of each group member. The members of the group are instructed by the facilitator as follows, as outlined by Alex Osborne, the inventor of the brainstorming technique. 1. Criticism is ruled out. Negative evaluations of ideas must be withheld until later. This was a quote. If this rule was not followed, it would inhibit many of the group members from contributing ideas, especially original thoughts. New ideas can sound nonsensical and impractical, especially before the idea is modified for application. Thus, many group members would be inhibited if they thought their ideas would result in criticism. 2. Free-willing suggestions are welcomed. The wider the ideas, the better. It is easier to tame down an idea than to perk it up. This was a quote. Wild ideas can sometimes be modified into practical solutions, or they can stimulate creative thinking. If the wild idea is funny, it can put the group in an uninhibited state. That is, once a few wild ideas are voiced, the group members will most likely feel free to present their thoughts, without fear of embarrassment. 3. Quantity is wanted. The greater the number of ideas, the greater the likelihood of winners. This was a quote. This is a primary component of the basic model of creativity that I presented earlier. It is part of natural evolutionary systems. That is, a huge number of genetic variations of both plants and animals have been produced by nature, and a relatively small number of species are selected by environmental conditions for long-term survival and reproduction. The same principle is involved with brainstorming. That is, a huge number of ideas are produced, and after the brainstorming is completed, only a few good ideas are selected. 4. Combinations and improvements are sought. In addition to contributing ideas of your own, You should suggest how the ideas of others can be turned into better ideas or how two or more ideas can be joined into still another one. This was a quote as suggested above. Often new ideas are impractical, but they can be modified into practical ideas. This rule can focus the group's attention away from criticism, toward attempts to improve the ideas offered by the group members. To facilitate creative thinking, Alex Osborne created a list of 75 questions, which were meant to be voiced by the facilitator, when needed in the brainstorming session. A sample of these questions is as follows. How can this issue, idea, or thing be put to other uses? This was a quote, finding additional uses for an entity can sometimes result in true innovations. For example, microwaves were originally used in radar and high-frequency radio transmission systems. Someone came up with the idea of using microwaves for heating and cooking, which resulted in a new type of oven. How can it be modified? This was a quote, modifying a useless idea can sometimes result in an excellent solution to a problem. Even good ideas can sometimes be modified into ideas that are even better. How can it be substituted for something else, or can something else be substituted for part of it? This was a quote, when a new product is created, its utility and potential market is often determined by what it can be substituted for. A good example is the steam engine was substituted for the power produced by horses. How could it be reversed? This was a quote, sometimes reversing the way an entity functions can result in a new product. For example, a steam engine is essentially a pump working in reverse. In addition, sometimes attempting to reverse an idea, even if it cannot be reversed in a sensible way, can stimulate the mind, which can result in totally new insights and ideas. How could it be combined with other things? This was a quote, to use many inventions, it is necessary to figure out how it can be combined with other entities. An example is the gasoline engine, which was essentially combined with a horse carriage to create an automobile. A brainstorming session can sometimes result in the development of good solutions or innovations. However, most of the ideas that develop are likely to be impractical, unworkable, unrealistic, or in a raw state requiring further development. Thus, a primary task is to sort out the useless ideas and select the few ideas that can be developed into useful solutions or innovations. The selection process is carried out after the brainstorming session has been completed. It might be carried out by upper management, the management of a specific organizational department, or another group or individual. In theory, it could also be carried out by the participants of the brainstorming group after the brainstorming session has been completed. The above discussion suggests the obvious question. Does brainstorming really work? Is it an effective strategy to develop new ideas and solve problems? The use of the technique sometimes results in the development of highly useful ideas. The simple brainstorming technique, as presented above, is probably more effective in non-technical creative tasks, such as developing advertising slogans. In fact, it was created primarily for that purpose. The inventor, Alex Osborne, was an advertising executive. The above suggests the question, what does research indicate about brainstorming? The answer is, it is more effective to develop creative ideas by working alone. For example, if you have 5 people, you can obtain more ideas from them, in a given period of time, if they work alone. However, this does not mean that brainstorming groups do not work. It means that an equal number of individuals brainstorming alone will be more efficient. This is probably especially the case when working with technical material that involves complicated logical and/or mathematical relationships, because it requires much time and a high level of concentration. The superior creative capability of people working alone is no mystery to individuals who are familiar with group dynamics. Most people are somewhat inhibited by a group structure. They tend to be influenced and limited in their verbalizations by a relatively small number of group participants who do most of the talking. Another limiting factor of brainstorming groups is most people, especially in the work environment, do not want to present ideas that might be misinterpreted and which might reflect negatively on them as employees or co-workers. They do not want to offend people who have more power than they do, such as their supervisor or boss. If they neglect this concern, they might be risking their relationships with their employer and co-workers, as well as jeopardizing their employment. Thus, a participant in a group might only want to present ideas that would not be offensive and would please her boss. This can severely limit the creative production of a brainstorming group. Another dynamic that might limit the effectiveness of brainstorming groups was suggested by Michael Diehl and Wolfgang Straub in 1991, which is as follows. When an individual is a group member, she cannot talk until she is called on. If she gets an idea, she might have to hold it in memory until she is permitted to speak. During this time, She cannot engage in creative thinking, because her memory and her efforts are focused elsewhere. That is, her efforts are focused on retaining the idea and getting the attention of the group facilitator, which wastes time and effort. When working alone, the individual simply writes down ideas as soon as it comes to her. She does not have to waste time and effort to get the attention of the group facilitator. In spite of the relevant inefficiency of brainstorming, it is still frequently used. Brainstorming groups probably perform additional functions besides creative thinking. Bringing people together in a group when they are faced with a difficult task or a threatening problematic condition can sometimes be very reassuring and emotionally satisfying. When people are given an assignment to work alone, to create new ideas, there is always the possibility of procrastination, especially if the task is difficult or anxiety-provoking. The brainstorming group eliminates this type of procrastination problem. A fairly good alternative to the brainstorming group is suggested by the above paragraphs. One or more individuals brainstorming alone can be quite effective. This technique is probably most effective if there are no time limits placed on the brainstorming individuals. They can carry a pad with them to write down their ideas as they come to mind. They can even use information from a large number of sources, such as books and friends, to stimulate their creative thinking. This technique allows the individual second all the time needed to work on problems that might be too difficult or technical for a conventional brainstorming group. Brainstorming alone is also excellent for personal problems, where the use of a group might be impractical. Of course, this technique does not really replace the conventional brainstorming group. It is apparent that brainstorming groups have their special advantages as well as limitations. The above discussion suggests the question: is it possible to circumvent the difficulties with brainstorming groups and create a more effective methodology? The answer is found with modern computer technology. There is a variation of the technique called electronic brainstorming, which is defined by Hal Riegel and Slocum, pages 761, as use of technology to input and automatically disseminate ideas in real time over a computer network to all team members, each of whom may be stimulated to generate other ideas. This was a quote. This method involves a number of computers connected together. The physical location of the computers and the group participants is irrelevant. That is, the group members and their computers can be in the same room, spread throughout the building, located in different areas of the United States, or spread throughout the world. The group participants can type in their ideas at any point in time, even if another person is typing in her ideas simultaneously. There are software packages that were specifically created for electronic brainstorming. One package is made by Group Systems and it is called Electronic Brainstorming. The software is especially created to conceal the identity of the group participants. When an idea is typed into the computer system, it appears on the computer screens in random order. Thus, electronic brainstorming appears to eliminate the difficulties associated with conventional brainstorming. With the electronic technique, it is even possible to extend the group meeting for hours, days, weeks, or months, or even to have it as a continuous ongoing process. This is possible because at any point in time an individual can enter the system and type in her ideas. The group members do not have to be concerned about what others will think of their ideas because the identities of all the participants are concealed. This is a great advantage, but it also is a highly significant disadvantage, because the brainstorming participants do not get credit for good ideas. Obtaining credit for innovative and creative ideas is extremely important in most fields, especially in engineering and science. Thus, the employees might refuse to submit their best ideas into an electronic brainstorming system, because they might not get credit for it. It is also important for management to know who is submitting highly useful or profitable ideas, because that is the individual that should be consulted on an ongoing basis, and that is the individual that the company would want to promote. This disadvantage might be circumvented if the individual that is submitting a potentially valuable idea documents her submission by submitting it in writing before it is inserted into the electronic brainstorming system to another individual who can act as a witness. Most of the benefits of electronic brainstorming can be achieved with written statement, which can be anonymously submitted to a group facilitator, such as by mail or a suggestion box set up specifically for the purpose. The group leader equals S task would be to place the suggestions on a blackboard or bulletin board, so all the participants can see the ideas that were developed by other group members. This technique, which I will call brainstorming by documentation, would be much slower than electronic brainstorming. However, this method can be set up in such a way that one person records who submitted each idea, with the understanding that their names will only be associated with the idea if the submission is accepted and used by the organization. A modified version of the above can be used to obtain ideas from individuals that are not employed by the company on an ongoing basis, such as experts, suppliers, wholesalers, retailers, customers, and potential consumers. This can be done through the mail, and I will call it brainstorming by mail. To use this method, you only have to explain the problem in writing, provide appropriate instructions about brainstorming, and supply a series of general questions or statements such as the following. What are all the possible solutions you can suggest for this problem? What are all the possible ways that this problem might be solved? List all the possible solutions to this problem. List all the things that are wrong with our product. List all of the ways that our product might be improved. To stimulate the creativity process, with brainstorming by mail you can send the responses of the participants back to them, requesting more ideas and improvements in the already submitted ideas. This can be done a number of times, until you have achieved your brainstorming objective. Hence, brainstorming by mail more or less resembles the Delphi technique, which will be discussed later in this chapter. Thus, there are potentially a limitless number of variations of the brainstorming technique. 5 variations were presented above. These techniques, as well as any creativity method, can probably be made more effective, especially for difficult problems, if the participants engage in serious study of relevant material before they attempt to solve problems or develop new ideas. The more detailed and prolonged the study, the greater the chances of obtaining satisfactory results from the creativity methodologies. Multidisciplinary studies can sometimes be especially useful, because it can suggest new ways of looking at and obtaining solutions and goals. However, for relatively simple tasks, such as developing conventional advertising slogans, study is probably not usually necessary. Other techniques that can help with problem solving and goal attainment. Another problem solving technique, which is more structured than conventional brainstorming, involves creating a cause and effect diagram. This method was invented by Keiru Ishikawa, and the diagram that results from the method is sometimes called Ishikawa diagram or a fishbone diagram. Hal Riegel and Slocum described this technique in their book pages 286, and they defined it as a chart that helps team members display, categorize and evaluate all the possible causes of an effect, which is generally expressed as a problem. This was a quote. This technique can be used with conventional brainstorming, and it is often done in a group situation similar to a brainstorming group. However, there is no reason why one individual could not perform the task working alone, such as for a personal problem. The method involves creating a cause and effect diagram by means of the following steps. 1. How can the problem be stated in terms of a result? That is, the problem is delineated in terms of an effect. The group must come to an agreement in this regard. To do this, they may use brainstorming or other techniques. 2. What are all the factors involved with the problem? That is, the group identifies all the possible components that are involved with the problem. 3. How can the factors that relate to the problem be put into categories? That is, the group tries to put the factors they obtained in step 2 into categories. This step can be done as part of step 2 or it can be done after step 4. With this method, commonly used categories are equipment, materials, methods and people. Other possible categories include the following: psychological, sociological, biological, chemical, physical, system, subsystem, internal environment, external environment, management, employees, consumers, cultural, economic, political, etc. 4. What are the cause and effect relationships between the factors and the problem? The group attempts to answer the question, what causes this cause? This was a quote. That is, they try to delineate the cause and effect relationships, such as factor A caused or contributed to factor B, which caused or contributed to factor C, which caused or contributed to factor D, etc., which caused the undesirable effect, which is the problem. 5. What are the top 3 to 5 root causes in each of the categories that the group delineated? That is, the group attempts to simplify their information by selecting 3 to 5 factors in each category. For example, they might select factors A, B and C from the equipment category and reject factors D, E and F. The same process of selection and rejection of relevant factors are repeated for the other categories, such as materials, methods and people. This is risky, because it is easy to reject inadvertently factors that might be primary contributing components to the problem. The factors that the group selected are considered to be the root causes of the problem. They are put on a diagram, with arrows indicating how they contributed to the problem. This generally results in a diagram that more or less resembles the bone configuration in a fish. I believe when making such a diagram, it might be better under certain conditions to indicate how the factor relates to the cause and effect sequence. The following examples will clarify this idea. Factor A may have caused factor B. Factor B definitely contributed to factor C. Factor D was caused by an interaction of factor C and X. Factor 10 was probably caused by either factors W, Y, or Z. Factor F influenced the manifestation of factor P, which influenced the manifestation of factor S. Factor W partly influenced the manifestation of factor V. Factor H was caused by one or more unknown factors. 6. How can the result S from step 5 be evaluated and corrected in relation to its utility as a problem-solving tool? Perhaps the easiest way to evaluate the usefulness of the information obtained in step 5 is to apply it to the problem-solving effort. This will indicate its relative degree of accuracy and utility. It will also suggest deficiencies in the information, which can be corrected with further creative thinking efforts. I added this step because it is usually necessary to evaluate and correct information that relates to a problem-solving effort. If this is not done, it is easy to develop belief systems that have no validity or direct utility in solving the problem. The above technique can be modified in various ways to fit the specific set of circumstances surrounding a problem. In some cases, it might be more effective to delineate multiple effects and show the relationships in a configuration that does not look like a traditional fishbone diagram. For example, it is possible to have a cause and effect sequence that involve a circular relationship between factors. It is possible to draw a fishbone diagram to deliberately create a desirable effect, which can be a goal. For example, it might be possible to create a cause and effect diagram to determine how to increase the profitability and size of a company. It is also possible to create a cause and effect diagram to delineate how a positive effect historically resulted. For example, cause and effect diagrams can be created for a number of highly successful organizations involved in manufacturing. Then it might be possible to determine the strategies that can maximize chances of success for a new company involved in manufacturing. That is, a fishbone diagram can be created for the new company, with the aim of duplicating the success of the older companies. The factors that affect or influence employees, machinery, organizations, and in general reality, can form various configurations, which might become apparent if they are placed on a cause and effect diagram. There are essentially a limitless number of such configurations. The most interesting of these arrangements of factors are discussed in the following paragraphs. One of the simplest configurations can be called the domino effect. This configuration involves factor A causing factor B, which causes factor C, etc., with the final effect being either positive or negative depending on the nature of the factors. This can involve one event causing another event, etc., which ultimately causes a problem. It can also involve a sequence of problems that were all caused by the first problem in the sequence. A hypothetical example of the domino effect is as follows: a maintenance technician is absent from a production facility for 2 weeks. This resulted in breakdowns of the machinery. The unskilled employees repaired the machines to the best of their ability. The machines were not repaired correctly. As a result, a fatal accident took place. The union blamed the accident on management and called a strike. The CEO blamed the behavior of the employees for the accident and refused to negotiate with the union. The union got angry and demanded better working conditions, more maintenance personnel, and large salary increases to compensate the workers for dangerous conditions. As a result, the strike continued for many weeks and all production was stopped. This resulted in the loss of customers to competitors. When the strike was finally over, the company failed to win back its customers. This resulted in financial problems, which ultimately led to bankruptcy and unemployment for all involved. Another configuration can be called the vicious cycle. This starts out in a way that is similar to the domino effect, but it repeats in increasing cycles. That is, factor A causing factor B, which causes factor C, etc., which causes an effect, and the effect increases one or more of the factors, which increases the effect. This cycle can repeat many times under certain conditions, with a more or less continuous increase in the effect. The effect of the vicious cycle is usually considered to be negative, often a serious problem, but it can in reality be quite positive. There are people who started out with minimum financial resources and became extremely rich and developed huge corporations in a manner that fits the vicious cycle. A hypothetical example is as follows: an investment was made in a small business, which was operated with great skill. This resulted in a considerable profit, which was used to expand the size of the business. This resulted in even more profits. These profits were used to expand the business even further, which ultimately resulted in even more profits, which were also reinvested in the business. This resulted in many repetitions of the above cycle, involving reinvested of profits and business expansion. Another configuration of factors can be called the landslide. This involves one or more factors causing an effect. The resulting effect directly or indirectly causes other effects, which directly or indirectly cause other effects, etc. The effects of the landslide can be either positive, negative, or a combination of desirable and undesirable effects. The negative version of the landslide involves one problem causing other problems, which cause even more problems. Identifying potential negative landslides in its earliest stages and stopping the sequence can save a considerable amount of time, money, effort, and prevent much unnecessary suffering. A hypothetical example of a negative landslide is as follows. The hypothetical organization is controlled by a CEO that is experiencing a personal crisis. This causes her to make organizational decisions that cause emotional stress and other problems for the employees. The stressful condition of the employees results in an increase in absenteeism, a reduction in sales, an increase in product defects, and conflicts with the union, and lawsuits from unsatisfied customers. This results in severe financial problems for the organization, which results in a reduction in stock value and a much lower credit rating. As a result of the lower credit rating and the financial problems, the company cannot borrow money. The debts accumulate, and the company is forced into bankruptcy. This results in unemployment for the CEO and the people that worked under her. A self-fulfilling prophecy can also be represented with a cause and effect sequence. It results when a belief of an individual, group, or organization directly or indirectly causes a specific behavior pattern that causes an effect. This can be represented as factor A, which is the belief, causing factor B, which is the behavior pattern, which causes the effect. The effect of the self-fulfilling prophecy is usually considered to be an undesirable outcome, a problem. This is certainly not always the case. The outcome of a self-fulfilling prophecy can be quite positive. An example is a manager who believes she is liked by the employees, might treat them well, which can cause the workers to be truly fond of the manager. Theory 10 and Theory Y, which was previously discussed, can also involve a self-fulfilling prophecy, in some cases. Managers that believe in Theory X might treat the employees in a manner that motivates the workers to behave in a way that is consistent with Theory X. That is, the Theory X manager can inadvertently motivate her employees to avoid responsibility, to try to avoid work, to display low levels of intelligence, to avoid any creative efforts, etc. This can be represented in terms of factors as follows. Factor X, a managerial belief in Theory X causes factor B, the behavior of the manager, which causes the effect employees' behavior that is consistent with Theory X. The same idea can apply to managers that adhere to Theory Y. That is, they might treat their employees in the way that results in bringing out their better qualities, such as responsibility, industriousness, intelligence, and creativity. Of course, the above does not imply that a belief in Theory X or Theory Y will always result in a self-fulfilling prophecy. The point is that it might under some conditions. Under other conditions, the self-fulfilling prophecy phenomena might be irrelevant, or it might be only partly responsible for the employee's behavior. However, regardless of what our beliefs are, in business or in personal life, there is some tendency for the self-fulfilling prophecy to at least partly manifest in many situations. In real business situations and in life in general, a number of factor configurations can be happening simultaneously, such as a self-fulfilling prophecy combined with a domino effect, or a landslide coupled with a vicious cycle. It might be quite difficult to represent all the cause and effect sequences and the related factor configuration on a simple fishbone diagram. This is especially the case if you are faced with a set of difficult problems that resulted from a landslide. One approach, which is probably the best for the most difficult problems, is to create a diagram with the complexity needed to properly delineate the problem. Another approach is to search for the primary or most significant causes, and try to delineate them first. Then try to eliminate the less severe causes. This is similar to the simplification procedure that was already discussed in step 5. In addition, dividing complicated problems into smaller and simpler problems can result in success. The reason for this is obvious. It is easier to analyze and solve simpler problems. Another method that can result in obtaining valuable information that can lead to creative solutions to problems and goal attainment is experimentation. This can involve formal experimental procedures, involving precise controls and recording of data. However, informal experimentation involving simple trial and error can be more practical under most conditions. This can involve trying something to observe the outcome. That is, often, but not always, the best way to determine what will happen if something is done is to try it and carefully observe the results. However, There are situations where it is not feasible to perform an experiment because of financial factors, risks, time, facilities, equipment, etc. In such cases, it is sometimes possible to evaluate the entity or method in question by creating a simulation model. Question: what is a simulation model? Hellriegel and Slocum define simulation as pages 174a. Simulation is a representation of a real system. The simulation model usually describes the behavior of the real system or some aspect of it in quantitative and or qualitative terms. This was a quote. Actually, simulation models can be divided into four categories, which are computer models, structural models, microcosms, and mental models. These categories are discussed in the following paragraphs. A computer simulation model is a software representation of a system or subsystem and or its environment, which is created to behave and respond in a way that is similar to the real entity or entities. For example, a computer simulation model of a company, its sales force, its customers, its potential customers, and its competitors, might be able to predict the consequences of raising prices. Such a model also might be able to predict the potential reduction in sales if a major competitor lowers prices. Computer simulation models are also useful in teaching employees how to operate potentially dangerous machines such as construction equipment. These models can involve virtual reality, which is described by Hellriegel and Slocum as follows, pages 176. A new technology, virtual reality, is a surrogate environment created by communications and computer systems. The term denotes a simulated environment into which a user enters, this was a quote, moves around, and interacts with objects. Virtual reality fulfills the sensory requirements of human beings for sight, sound, and movement, this was a quote. With a computer model incorporating virtual reality, it is possible to test the functionality of a machine before the first prototype is built. This can involve placing potential users of the machine into a computer-simulated environment with a control panel that is identical to the panel plant for the real machine. With this type of virtual reality testing, it is possible to eliminate design errors, such as poor location of control knobs, before the device is built. Structural models differed from computer models with respect to their real material form. That is, structural models are physical entities that are designed to behave in a way that is similar to the real system. For example, to evaluate the functionality of a new airplane design, the engineering team might build a structural model out of plastic or metal and test it in a wind tunnel. It is possible to manipulate such models in various ways, including modifying its design, to determine if a better design is possible. It is also possible to determine how a system will behave under different conditions with a structural model. A microcosm is a small system that behaves and responds in a way that is more or less similar to a much larger system, with respect to one or more factors. For example, it is possible to find relatively small geographical areas in the United States that mimics the buying behavior of the entire country. Such a system can obviously be used for market research. It is possible to find small organizations that are microcosms of giant organizations. It is even possible to find departments in large organizations that are microcosms of the entire organization. In theory, it should be possible to create such models deliberately. However, this might not be practical in most cases, except for certain situations involving experimental research. The three categories of simulation models discussed above are usually not a practical way to evaluate and solve management or personal problems. The computer models generally must be created by computer programmers for the desired purpose, which can take many months of work. In addition, computer simulations of human behavior, such as organizational behavior or consumer buying habits, are based on statistics and many theoretical assumptions. Such models can provide only rough approximations of reality at best, unless there is a continuous input of corrective data from the real system. Structural models also must be created specifically for an intended purpose, which generally makes them only practical for problems faced by the engineering department. Microcosms are usually not practical unless you are doing statistical evaluations or a scientific study. However, there is one highly practical simulation methodology that is quite practical for all types of problem solving, which is the mental simulation model. What is a mental simulation model? It is a simulation of a system created in the mind of an individual. Such models can be composed of sensory data, such as mental imagery, coupled with knowledge and experience of how various entities behave. These models are part of our mental conceptions of reality. They allow us to predict the way people in other systems will change and respond under various conditions. That is, these models give us the ability to make estimates and predictions. We all use mental simulation models whether we are conscious of it or not. When we are not conscious of our use of mental simulation models, we probably will attribute our predictive abilities to intuition. When people observe an individual successfully using mental simulation models, they will probably also call it intuition. The similarity between the two phenomena will become apparent in the following paragraphs. Most of us have mental models of our neighborhood and the buildings we live and work in. We usually also have good mental simulation models of the people we know well, such as our best friend, our parents, our husband, our wife, our children. Such models are not the result of pure imagery. They allow us to make estimations, predict behavior, and answer related questions, with varying degrees of accuracy. For example, the following questions can be answered, with a degree of accuracy ranging from excellent to poor, by human beings because they have a mental simulation model of the relevant entities. How much time will be required for you to walk from your home to work? How much time will be required to travel by car from the neighborhood you grew up in to the place where you are now employed? How will your father behave if you drop out of college? How will your wife behave if you quit your job? How will your boss behave if you ask for a raise? What would happen if your company reduced the prices for its product by 10%? What would happen if it raised its prices by 10%? What would happen if your company reduced salaries by 10%? Of course, it is not possible to answer such questions with certainty, because our mental models of reality are not perfect. This is usually the case also with the other models discussed above. That is, with the other simulation methods, including the computer techniques, it is usually not possible to answer most of these questions with certainty either. However, with mental simulations it is easy to make corrections in our mental models with feedback. We can probably increase our skill and ability to make estimations and predictions with our mental simulation models by practicing all of the ideas in the following paragraphs on an ongoing basis. Develop an awareness of the mental simulation process and the models that develop within your mind. This should include carefully observing the various components and behaviors of relevant systems, such as people, groups, organizations, the environment, with the goal of creating a useful mental simulation model. This also involves learning about the systems in detail and developing a good mental image of all its aspects. Correct your mental models based on the feedback you receive. This can include making estimates and predictions, even if it is not necessary, and making corrections based on the reality that manifests. This can involve verbalizing your estimates and predictions to yourself, or putting it in writing, and making the needed corrections when you have information from the actual reality. When you are in a situation where you might benefit from making estimates or predictions, do the following 8 steps. 1. Carefully visualize all the relevant components of the system you plan to make estimates and or predictions about. Then think about all the information you have about the system. Ask yourself, do I have all the information I need? What specific information will help me make more accurate estimates and or predictions? Where can I obtain this information? If necessary and feasible, obtain more information. 2. Create relevant questions that relate to the needed estimates or predictions. This is best done in writing. Examples of such questions are as follows. How will Ms. X respond when I tell her about her new work responsibilities? What will happen after the system is modified? What will happen at the meeting? How long will it take Ms. Y to complete the paperwork? What will Ms. Y do next? How can I get along better with Ms. Y? What is the best way to communicate with Ms. Y? What will probably happen tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, etc.? 3. Then provide multiple answers to each question you created, which ideally should be done in writing. That is, create a number of answers to each question. When you are creating the answers, keep in mind that they should be the best estimates or predictions that you can devise. 4. Arrange the answers you created in order of likelihood of correctness. That is, the best answer should be placed first, the second best second, the third best third, etc. If you have a large number of answers, remove the answers that are unlikely to be correct. For example, if answers were provided for the question, how will Ms. X respond when I tell her about her new work responsibilities? The answers could consist of the following 1. Ms. X will probably accept the new work responsibilities, but she will be displeased about the change. 2. Ms. X will not like the new responsibilities, but she will accept the new work assignment. 3. Ms. X will dislike the new assignments, and she will refuse to do the assigned work. 5. After you created the list of questions in step 4, create a set of plans to deal with each of the possible outcomes. The following examples, using the questions that relate to Ms. X, will clarify this step 1. Ms. X will probably accept the new work responsibilities, but she will be displeased about the change. If this is the case, she can be assigned immediately. 2. Ms. X will not like the new responsibilities, but she will accept the new work assignment. If this is the case, she will be temporarily assigned to the new work, until we can find an employee that is qualified and willing to take the new job. 3. Ms. X will dislike the new assignments, and she will refuse to do the assigned work. If this is the case, then we will let Ms. X keep her old job, and we will place an ad in the paper for a new employee to carry out the new work assignment. 6. If you like the predicted outcome as you made by answering your questions, skip this step and go directly to step 7. However, if you do not like the predicted outcomes that you obtained in step 5, ask yourself, how can I change the outcome to the results I want? What actions can I take to change the predicted outcome to results that are more desirable? Or how can I change my plans to obtain a better predictive outcome? The above example involving Ms. X can be used to illustrate this idea. It is apparent from the three answers that Ms. X will probably be displeased with the new work assignment, even if she accepts the assignment. 1. Ms. X will probably accept the new work responsibilities, but she will be displeased about the change. This prediction can be changed by taking the appropriate action, such as modifying the new work responsibilities according to the personal preference of Ms. X, and or giving Ms. X an increase in salary, and or a promotion to a higher job status. After taking corrective action or changing your plans to obtain a better predictive outcome, repeat steps 3 to 6, or ideally repeat all the steps on the list. 7. Evaluate your answers, which are your estimates and predictions. This is done by evaluating what actually happens in the real situation. If everything turned out as you believed it would, you can do everything according to your plans. If your estimates and or predictions were partly or totally incorrect, modify your plans accordingly. 8. When you carry out your plans, evaluate them for effectiveness, and make any modifications or corrections that are needed to obtain your objective. Another important component involved with problem solving and goal attainment is our assumptions. Assumptions can be based directly or indirectly on the mental simulation models the individual has in relation to a specific problem or goal. This suggests the question, what are assumptions? Hellriegel and Slocum define assumptions as the underlying thoughts and feelings of one or more individuals that are taken for granted and believed to be true. This was a quote. This is an extremely general, but useful definition. I will also define the term for this book in a highly general way, which is as follows. Assumptions are premises we base our reasoning and actions on, and they can include our theories, beliefs, culturally related convictions, expectations, values, thoughts, feelings, and fears. Note, both of the above definitions include emotional components, feelings, which are not usually considered to be assumptions. The reason I included emotional components in my definition is, these factors are highly relevant in most problem-solving situations, except when the problem is based on pure mathematics or symbolic logic. I assume Hellriegel and Slocum included emotional components in their definition for the same reason I did. Incidentally, more conventional definitions of an assumption are a premise used in reasoning, or a premise used in a logical sequence resulting in a conclusion. However, these conventional definitions are not likely to be very useful when dealing with the complex problems of organizations and individuals, because emotional and cultural components are involved. End of note. The assumptions we have can either help us or hurt us, in relation to problem solving and goal attainment. Incorrect or inappropriate assumptions can handicap us in reaching our objectives. We may not even be totally aware of the underlying assumptions we are using in our efforts to solve a problem or obtain a goal. This raises the question, how can we assess the utility of our assumptions in a particular problem-solving situation? The following list of questions can help make us aware of our assumptions. Answer these questions in writing, in relation to the problem or goal you are working on. Promise yourself that you will not show your answers and comments to anyone, because this will allow you to write more honestly and with greater freedom. After you answer these questions in detail, carefully evaluate your answers. Try and evaluate the relative degree of functionality or dysfunctionality of your assumptions, in relation to the problem or goal you are trying to obtain. What are your beliefs about this situation? Write down all the beliefs that might be involved in your reasoning or emotional responses, in relation to the problem or goal you are working on. What theories or hypotheses do you have that relate to the situation? Write about all the theoretical and hypothetical perspectives that are involved in your reasoning in relation to the objective you are trying to obtain. How are your cultural convictions influencing you in this situation? Write about all the cultural components that may be affecting your actions, in relation to obtaining the goal or solving the problem. How are your values influencing you in this situation? Write about all the values that may be affecting your actions in relation to the problem or goal you are working on. What are your thoughts in this situation? Write down all your thoughts that relate to the problem or goal. What are your feelings in regard to the situation you are dealing with? Describe your feelings in writing in relation to the problem or goal you are working on. What are your concerns or fears in this situation? Describe your concerns and fears in writing in relation to the objective you are trying to achieve. Another way of evaluating our assumptions, as well as our plans and conclusions, is with the devil's advocacy technique, or some variation of this method. Hellriegel and Slocum define the devil's advocacy method as the selection of one person in a decision-making group, the devil's advocate, to critique a preferred plan or strategy. This was a quote. I am defining the term as a methodology that consists of an individual or a group that challenges, argues against assumptions, plans, goals, or anything else that relates to problem solving or goal attainment, for the purpose of stimulating careful evaluation, revaluation, and creative thinking. The devil's advocate method can help an individual or a group to consider all relevant factors, to develop contingencies, and to spot errors. That is, sometimes a plan or decision can look perfect on paper, because major realities were not considered. A skilled individual or a group acting as a devil's advocate can make these errors apparent. A good devil's advocate, according to Hellriegel and Slocum, is as follows. The devil's advocate acts like a good trial lawyer, presenting arguments against the proposed position as convincingly as possible. She or he tries to punch holes in the assumptions underlying the plan, draw out the internal inconsistencies in the proposed course of action, and reveal problems that may lead to its failure. This was a quote. Just like a trial lawyer, the individual, or group, playing the role of the devil's advocate does not necessarily believe in the position that she is advocating. Her goal is to argue her case to the best of her ability, given the facts and circumstances that she is faced with. However, unlike a trial lawyer, a devil's advocate should avoid directly or indirectly verbally attacking other individuals as she argues her case. There are some potential disadvantages to the devil's advocacy technique, which might be apparent from the above description. The criticism can be perceived as insulting by some individuals. The critical assessment can result in the rejection of a good plan, because some unrealistic fears or concerns were generated by the devil's advocate. The process can reveal minor weaknesses in a plan, and greatly exaggerate the significance of the deficiencies. This could result in a rejection, rather than a correction, of the entire plan. Thus, I will present an alternative technique, without the above difficulties, in the following paragraph. You can be your own devil's advocate, and evaluate and criticize your own assumptions, ideas, plans, conclusions, reports, or any type of entity you created. This can be done before you submit such material to your boss or to a committee. The technique involves answering the following questions in relation to the assumptions, ideas, plans, conclusions, etc., that you want to evaluate. The method involves 4 steps, and it is in certain ways similar to the brainstorming technique. However, this method can be performed by one individual or by a group. Note in the following list, the word plan was used to simplify the text. Thus, plan can mean in this list all of the following assumptions, conclusions, design, goals, plans, reports, any type of documentation, or anything that relates to problem solving or goal attainment. 1. What are all the things that are wrong with your plan? Create a written list of as many deficiencies as possible in relation to your plan. 2. Carefully evaluate the deficiencies that you wrote about in step 1, and then remove the invalid entries from your list. That is, remove the deficiencies that are not relevant or true problems from your list. 3. Rewrite the list you created and place the deficiencies in order of importance. That is, the most significant deficiency should be first, the second most significant deficiency should be second, etc. 4. For each of the deficiencies in your plan, answer the following question: what are all the possible ways that I can correct this deficiency? Then list all the possible ways of making the needed corrections. Select the best way of making the corrections and apply it to your plan. Then evaluate your plan to be sure that you successfully made the needed corrections. In the above paragraphs, many problem-solving techniques were discussed, and it should be apparent from these discussions that 2 of the primary components for complex problem-solving and goal attainment are 1. Information, which involves learning, and 2. Expert assistance. This discussion will be focused on the latter, because there are a number of difficulties associated with the use of experts. Experts do not always agree. Even experts in the same field will give different advice, different estimates, different forecasts, and different opinions. Expert assistance can be very expensive, especially if the expert has to travel to the worksite to provide assistance. These difficulties can be greatly reduced by the Delphi technique and its variations. This will become apparent in the following paragraphs. What is the Delphi technique? Hellriegel and Slocum defined it as pages 173. A forecasting aid based on a consensus of a panel of experts. This was a quote. Robbins defines Delphi technique as a group decision method in which individual members, acting separately, pool their judgments in a systematic and independent fashion. This was a quote. The Delphi technique involves a number of experts, who are given questionnaires and relevant information about a problem or goal, with the aim of achieving a consensus on a specific issue. The questionnaires and information were traditionally transmitted by conventional mail. The technique was originally created by Norman Dowke and Olaf Helmer at the RAND Corporation, in the early 1950s. Their goal was to collect information from experts, and feed it back to them to form a consensus on the effects of a Soviet nuclear attack on our military defenses. The basic technique, as expressed by Robbins pages 325, is as follows. 1. The problem is identified and members are asked to provide potential solutions through a series of carefully designed questionnaires. This was a quote. That is, the problem is defined, a number of experts are selected, their task is explained to them, and they are asked to give their forecasts or estimates, or solutions, to a particular problem as delineated in a series of questionnaires, which were traditionally sent through the mail. However, in modern times, electronic methods might be used to send the questionnaires to the participants. 2. Each member anonymously and independently completes the first questionnaire. This was a quote. The idea behind the words anonymously and independently is important. The reason for this is human beings in all, or almost all, cultures, subcultures and societies tend to be influenced consciously or unconsciously by individuals with high prestige. If the questionnaires were not filled out anonymously and independently, the expert with the highest prestige might inadvertently influence the other experts. 3. Results of the first questionnaire are compiled at a central location, transcribed, and reproduced. This was a quote. This is essentially a report on the questionnaires. However, it will generally include either the same questions or a modified set of questions to be answered by each expert. 4. Each member receives a copy of the results. This was a quote. The report compiled in step 3 is sent to each of the experts. This was traditionally done by mail, but in modern times electronic methods might be used, such as email or fax machines. 5. After viewing the results, members are again asked for their solutions. The results typically trigger new solutions or cause changes in the original position. This was a quote. The report that was sent to the experts in step 4 is independently reviewed by each expert. This usually stimulates their thinking, and new or modified forecasts, estimates, or solutions usually develop. That is, the information from each expert modifies the opinions of the other experts, which eventually can result in a consensus. 6. Steps 4 and 5 are repeated as often as necessary until consensus is reached. This was a quote. As these steps are repeated, generally a consensus is approached. To achieve a true consensus, in a situation where there is much disagreement, steps 4 and 5 will have to be repeated a number of times. According to Harold A. Lindstone, Writing and Group Planning and Problem-Solving Methods in Engineering Management, edited by Shirley A. Olson, a typical Delphi study consists of the following. The study has from 5 to 40 experts participating, which is the case in 60% of the studies. The typical study is completed within 8 months. This is the case in 75% of the studies. Most of the studies use 3 or fewer questionnaires, which implies that consensus was achieved in 3 or less repetitions of steps 4 and 5. 43% of the studies cost under $5,000. This was a quote which appears to be based on prices in the early 1980s. However, it is apparent that the Delphi technique is quite economical. It can cost considerably more than $5,000 to temporarily hire one expert to work on a problem. The Delphi technique was originally created to estimate, such as how many Soviet atomic bombs will damage our defenses, and to make forecasts, such as the future of the steel and ferroalloy industry. However, the technique can be modified, and has been modified, to meet the needs of a particular study. It is possible to obtain expert information and solutions to almost any type of problem with the Delphi technique, if you are willing to make the appropriate modifications in the method. It does not even have to be used with experts, if you are trying to obtain a consensus of a specific group or category of people, such as your employees, your managers, your customers, etc. The primary disadvantage of the Delphi technique is the time it takes to send questionnaires to the participants, which was traditionally done by mail. In modern times, fax, email, and computer networks can be used. With a proper computer network, a consensus can be reached in a fraction of the time required for the traditional Delphi method. The Delphi technique is an excellent method when expert opinions are needed and experimentation cannot be used to obtain the required information. For example, to answer questions about the future, you must use intuition and opinion. However, if you are dealing with an issue that can be tested experimentally, you will probably obtain better results with the following. 1. Define the problem or goal you are working on. 2. Collect the information that relates to your problem. This can involve looking up information from the library, consulting experts, observing relevant systems in operation, and setting up general experiments to obtain data. 3. Formulate a hypothesis that can be tested experimentally. 4. Set up the experiment to determine if the hypothesis is true or false. Inductive reasoning is a major component of many problem-solving methodologies. It involves reasoning from a particular case to the general case. It is a primary component of scientific observation and experimentation, where information is obtained on a sample of a specific type of entity, and is then generalized to all such entities. For example, an observer evaluates a sample of flying animals, the specifics such as bees, pigeons, and bats, and then concludes that all animals that fly have wings. The general. The potential difficulties with inductive reasoning include the following. The observed sample is too small, the sample is not representative of the general category under study, or there are unknown exceptions in the general category. These potential difficulties can result in developing completely irrational or incorrect beliefs, hypotheses, and theories. The difficulties associated with inductive reasoning are likely to manifest in human behavior studies, including studies on management and organizational behavior. The reason for this is each person is a unique entity, with their own genetic makeup, personality, culture, and subculture. In addition, people behave according to environmental conditions and what they believe about the specific circumstances. Thus, it can be difficult, or impossible, to generalize accurately from a small experimental sample of human beings to all humans throughout the world. Deductive reasoning is more or less the opposite of the above. It involves reasoning from a general principle to a specific case. It starts with a basic assumption, such as all animals that fly have wings. If we use this premise in a hypothetical example, such as Ms. X found a new animal that can fly. The logical conclusion, if the premise is correct, is Ms. X found a new animal that has wings. The potential difficulties with deductive reasoning include incorrect assumptions and incorrect application of the method. As implied in the earlier discussion, assumptions can be quite incorrect and even totally irrational. If such assumptions are used in the deductive reasoning process, incorrect conclusions will result. This can occasionally happen by inadvertently modifying a correct assumption. For example, using the above assumption all animals that fly have wings can result in incorrectly concluding that all animals with wings fly. This change in wording results in a totally different assumption, which happens to be incorrect. Applying this incorrect assumption to ostriches will result in the erroneous conclusion that the giant birds fly. The different categories of problems. The problems that organizations and people face in their personal lives can be divided into several categories. The different categories suggest different problem-solving methodologies. This is illustrated in the following list, which summarizes some of the ideas presented in this chapter, and will serve as the chapter conclusion. Problems that involve decision-making. The following questions illustrate examples of this type of problem. Which applicants should we hire? Which machines should we purchase? Some decision-making involves a simple yes or no, such as the following. Should we sell the new product line offered by Company X? Should I buy the newest Ford automobile? Experimentation is a good method of dealing with this type of problem. For example, in making a decision involving the hiring of job applicants, the solution can be to hire all the qualified applicants temporarily and evaluate their job performance in the specific situation. Then permanently hire the individual that performs best. If we use the car as an example, the solution can involve renting the specific model and test driving it for a few days to decide if you should purchase it. Another way of dealing with decision-making problems is with some type of simulation model, which is certainly not as precise as an actual experimental trial. This can involve testing your choices with a simulation, such as evaluating your decision with a mental simulation of the relevant entity. For example, if a manager needs to choose an assistant manager from the employees that work under her, she can use a mental simulation model, if she knows the employees and their work performance quite well. This would involve the manager visualizing the behavior patterns and work performance of each of the employees. Then the manager would visualize each of the employees working as an assistant manager and choosing the individual that appears to be the best based on her mental simulations. Problems that are technical in nature. These problems require technical knowledge to solve. If you do not have that knowledge, you simply need one or more individuals with appropriate training to help you solve the problem. In some cases, the untrained individual can solve technical problems herself if she is willing to invest the time needed to study the relevant information. Such study can be quite difficult and time-consuming. Situations that are the result of emotional or mental blocks that inhibit the actions or methods needed to obtain a solution or a goal. That is, sometimes there are highly effective and apparent methods to obtain a goal or solve a problem, but the individual as involved do not recognize or consider the obvious. The obvious solutions might be apparent to other people, but they are not apparent to the individuals facing the problem. If an outsider suggests the obvious solution or method to obtain a goal, the individual as involved with the problem might provide an irrational answer, such as, "That is not the way we do things around here, I could do that, I do not believe that will work for us, I will try that when we have time, we need a practical solution," etc. These types of emotional blocks are common in organizations and in the personal lives of individuals. They can be the result of one or more of the following established habits that interfere with the best course of action: cultural or social factors that interfere with goal attainment, groupthink, irrational fears, unjustified or incorrect assumptions, lack of experience with the obvious methods and solutions, an overemphasis on highly sophisticated methods that results in rejecting simpler and more effective methods, etc. Difficulties of this nature can sometimes be solved by determining what the nature of the mental block consists of. That is, the individuals faced with the mental block should answer questions such as, "Why can't we use the obvious method or solution?" The underlined words are to be replaced in these questions with a specific method or solution. What would happen if we used the obvious methods or solutions? What would the consequences be if we used the obvious methods or solutions, and are there any ways of circumventing the undesirable consequences? Are the undesirable consequences likely to manifest from the obvious methods or solutions? Are there really any potential undesirable consequences associated with the obvious methods or solutions? Why can't we try a short-term experimental evaluation with the obvious methods or solutions? Sometimes there are truly legitimate reasons for not using the obvious methods and solutions. Under other conditions, the individual as involved with the problem never seriously considered the obvious. In such cases, brainstorming or other types of creative thinking can help, especially if people that are not involved with the problem participate. The question to answer in the brainstorming process is, what are all the possible methods that can help with this goal? What are all the possible solutions to this problem? What are all the possible ways that most organizations or individuals would solve this problem? Each idea that is generated should be evaluated at a later point in time by answering the following questions: what would happen if we use this idea to solve our problem or obtain our goal? Are there really any significant risks involved with applying this idea? If there are, can the risks or adverse consequences be circumvented? Problems that have no apparent solutions. These are the most challenging problems to deal with. To solve these problems, an elaborate problem-solving methodology will probably work best, such as the 12-step method that was discussed earlier in this chapter. Such problems can sometimes be solved by, one, defining and analyzing the problem, with the aim of dividing the problem into simpler problems, which might be solved separately; 2, prolonged and detailed study of the problem; 3, experimentation; 4, contacting experts for assistance; 5, the application of creativity techniques; 6, creating detailed plans that delineate at least one solution; 7, devising methods of obtaining resources for the effort, because solving problems of this nature can sometimes be extremely expensive. This can sometimes be done by writing a report and submitting it to upper management of your company, another organization, or a government agency; 8, applying the plans you created and testing the solutions suggested by the plans. With difficult problems, it may be necessary to test many plans and solutions before the problem is totally solved. This means that the above steps would probably have to be repeated many times. Mathematical and logical problems. Mathematical and logical problems can be relatively easy to solve. These problems are based on pure logic, and generally no equipment, materials, or financial resources are required to obtain a solution. The solutions of mathematical and logical problems can usually be easily tested on paper or with a computer. If you have no knowledge in this area, you can easily obtain assistance from an expert who can solve the problem for you. However, mathematical and logical problems are often a part of more challenging problems that involve people, equipment, and financial resources.